Today, though, I'm delighted to welcome our distinguished guest, Father Drew Christensen of the Society of Jesus. This year, he's a visiting scholar in the theology department here at Boston College, and it's been our great honor to have him here as a colleague. In between two, he's been keeping a very busy writing and research and lecturing program here in this calendar year, in between two distinguished gigs that I'll mention in a second. He received his undergraduate degree from the seminary at Fordham University and his MDiv and STM from Woodstock College before taking a master's in philosophy and a doctorate from Yale. He's taught ethics and peace studies at Notre Dame, Jesuit School of Theology, and the GTU at Berkeley, and served as a fellow and director of the Woodstock Theological Center. From 91 to 98, he was director of the Office of International Justice and Peace of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and he's had a longstanding relationship with the Bishops Council since then. Among relevant work that he's done, among his many essays and publications, he was a principal advisor on the U.S. Bishops' policy articulated in The Harvest of Justice is Sown in Peace, which is now in its 20th anniversary, is that right? Which itself was marking the 10-year anniversary of the Challenge of Peace from the U.S. Bishops and the 30-year anniversary of Pacem in Terris. So we have a lot of papal and pastoral letter anniversaries this year to speak of as well. Two other things I'll mention. He came to Boston College after stepping down from a 7-year run as editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Weekly America magazine, very well respected, published by the Jesuits. And in January, he will take up his new position as Distinguished Professor of Ethics and Human Development at Georgetown University, with affiliation at the School of Foreign Service and its Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. He's a busy man, in addition to being a wonderful colleague, and it's our pleasure to have you here today. Thank you.
Thanks for the introduction, Eric.
Of course.
Thanks for your invitation. Thanks to Alan, too, for hosting me here. I'm very delighted to be with you all and to talk about these issues. This presentation is really an intersection of two things. One is an area I've written a lot about, which is the gradual shift of Catholic teaching on war and peace from just war to nonviolence. And the second is the use of signs of the times, both as an interpretation of history and as a method to interpret what's going on in the development of the teaching. It's part of a larger project that Charles Taylor is heading up, called the Disjunctions Project, which responds to a paper that Taylor wrote about a year and a half ago about disjunctions between the church at large and the hierarchy. And among the things it's looking at are pluralities in spiritualities in the church, also the difference between dwellers, people who are comfortable with the church's traditional settings and want to retain it, and those who are seekers who go wander beyond the church to look for something more, both those inside the church and those outside. And another area is the question of the role of experience in the development of moral teaching, as opposed to just apodictic teaching by the magisterium. And this particular paper that I've been working on, which will be finished at the end of the month, and for a group that's working out of Georgetown, there are 16 different universities involved in different kinds of projects, but we're the only one working on this issue of the relationship of experience and history to moral judgment. This is hosted at Georgetown, but involves people at other places, including Catholic University and Loyola University in New Orleans. If you take just the top sentence, which gives the title to the to my presentation, you'll see the quote that I took my inspiration from. This is from Chintasi Misonis. It's in a section looks at the events of 1989 and gives the Pope's own interpretation of them as motivated and moved along by nonviolent activists. It's by uniting his own sufferings for the sake of truth and freedom to the suffering of Christ on the cross that man is able to accomplish the miracle of peace and is in a position to discern the often narrow path between the cowardice which gives in to evil and the violence which, under the pretext of fighting evil, only makes it worse. I've underscored the last part, the discernment of the narrow path, because I think that it kind of expresses John Paul's own position with respect to the use of force, and that is that people under the title of the Just War frequently made it as make it a pretext, but in the, as you'll see, he sees war as only making situations generally worse. We'll talk about that later. That's another part of Shinte's Masonis. But he also doesn't think you should be satisfied with just enduring evil, that you need to do something against it. You need to defend against injustice and protect the innocent. I'll talk about that. At the time of World War II, Catholics who were pacifists went to prison for their beliefs, including Gordon Zahn, who later taught at the University of Massachusetts, who was probably one of the leading Catholic pacifists of his age, and a leader of Pax Christi, who in the end influenced a lot of church teaching on this doctrine. But at the time of the council, as it developed its teaching on war, as it talks about peace, it talks about recognizing the contribution of those who are nonviolent activists. Up until that time, as I said, Catholics could not be pacifists. But the council, recognizing what good had been done, writes, "We cannot fail to praise those who renounce the use of violence in the vindication of their rights, and who resort to methods of defense which are otherwise available to weaker parties too." What you have here is a revival of the pacifist, or at least the nonviolent tradition, in Catholicism, which had been neglected for several centuries. Brian Hare and then the bishops following him have said in Challenge of Peace that the just war was in possession from the time of Augustine on. I don't believe that. I know there were lots of pacifist movements led by bishops and popes, lots of pacifist teaching in the church, lots of pacifist movements up until the end of the Middle Ages. And it's only really with the age of absolutism and the formation of the modern nation state that the just war begins to be so firmly entrenched in Catholicism. And as John Howard Yoder used to say, you know, for Anglicans and Lutherans, just war is a matter of doctrine, because it's in the confessions of Westminster and of Augsburg. But there was no official teaching until the Catechism in 1994 that laid out the just war. It was always in the teachings of theologians. It may be applied by popes or bishops, different, but it was all in the ordinary magisterium of the church until that time. Part of this was the influence of nonviolence, both by Catholics and non-Catholics in the Second World War. It's part of an overall development. But they're very careful in keeping with the notion that you have to defend against injustice, to say that the nonviolent activists have to do what they do without injury to the rights and duties of others or of the common good itself. That's the first proviso that the council puts against a kind of a nonviolent approach. And the second one is one that allows for just war in a later number. It's what I call the great proviso, because people cite it over and over again. And I'm sure if Brian Hare were here, he'd put a great deal of emphasis on this principle as being the basis of kind of just war military ethics in the 21st century as well. As long as the danger of war remains and there is no competent and sufficiently powerful authority at the international level, governments cannot be denied the right to legitimate self-defense once every means of peaceful settlement has been exhausted. So there is the question of last resort, but nonetheless, there is a legitimacy to the use of war as a way to enforce justice in the world. The council itself spent most of its time dealing with issues of war and nuclear war. It condemned total war and genocide. It rejected blind obedience. and it made a major effort towards nuclear disarmament. Even the pacifists who were there, who represented Pax Christi USA and Pax Christi Great Britain, the lay people, including Zahn, put most of their efforts into the nuclear disarmament element. And some of the language used there was written by Jim Douglas, an American Catholic pacifist who's a well-known author as well. And he, according to Tom Cornell, he actually penned one of the lines of that section on disarmament. The praise of nonviolence by the Council, however, put an emphasis on the defense of justice. And my own argument over the years has been that for the Council, what united nonviolence and just war was that each was a way to protect against injustice. They have in common that they resist evil, and that the Church is not pacifist, it's peacemaking or nonviolent, because it insists that evil must be resisted, public evil, great public evil must be resisted. But beyond that, it didn't say anything. Later, the bishops in 1993, in the Challenge of Peace, argue that both have a presumption against war, which I think is true. The emphasis in the Council was on resistance, and I think that's important for laying out the Catholic position vis-a-vis the peace churches. The historic peace churches, at least, are basically war resistors. They're opposed to all war. And Catholic teaching still does not oppose all war. It criticizes war. It's very reluctant to give approval for war, and increasingly so. But it doesn't say all wrong is wrong. There can be justified use of force to defend against evil. In 1983, this is the 30th anniversary, the bishops published their peace pastoral, Challenge of Peace, God's Promise, it really educates the United States in just war teaching. It did that not only by laying it out, but by also making the teaching a process that was public. Some of you don't remember, but it was published in a series of published drafts that people could debate and then respond to the bishop. So there were four drafts. The final one is the fourth. But there were three drafts that were public and were debated in churches, in universities, and all sorts of people responded. Also, what was very important was that Pax Christi, which had inserted that little bit into, helped insert that little bit into this Gaudium et Spes, was also very active among the bishops who wrote the Challenge of Peace. There were at that time 116 bishops who were members of Pax Christi. So you had bishops who were, in a way, peace activists in favor of nonviolence. And the way the letter articulated it was that there were two distinct but intertwined traditions in the Church. Now, this is for a Church that had for three or four centuries insisted on just war and contrasted itself with the peace churches by saying, we have just war, we're not pacifist. To say that there were two traditions was a breakthrough. And they described it this way. The new moment in which we find ourselves, that is the moment of the nuclear standoff of the Cold War, sees the just war teaching and nonviolence as distinct but interdependent methods of evaluating warfare. They diverge on some specific conclusions, but they share a common presumption against the use of force as a means of settling disputes. Now, there is a common presumption, and that's articulated, and it's that rather than the resistance to evil, which is picked up by a lot of the the commentary, particularly by those who want a stronger, more permissive just war theory. What goes on with this document is that it creates a place in the church for pacifists which wasn't there before. And it talks principally about pacifism rather than nonviolence. And I think that's one of the shortcomings in it. But it talks principally about pacifists, the pacifist tradition. Okay. The next major step in, and the decisive one, I think, in the acceptance of nonviolence into the Catholic tradition comes in 1992 or 91, when John Paul II issues his encyclical Centesimus Annus on the 100th anniversary of Rerum Novarum. And it's mostly about the economic transformation taking place in Eastern Europe after the fall of communism. But tucked in there are three or four paragraphs about the use of force, and particularly in his reflections on what happened in 1989, and he talks about the defense of labor rights, for instance, as being part of Vietnam. What he articulates is a position of admiration of the nonviolent activism that made those events possible. Now remember, he's not just an observer, he's a participant observer. He had been a kind of counselor or spiritual advisor to the resistance in Poland. He had negotiated at one point with Brezhnev and later with Gorbachev to prevent the Soviet Union from coming in and putting down by force the potential rebellions that were taking place. So he talks for what he knows, and he says, and this is his view, it seemed that the European order resulting from the Second World War and sanctioned by the Alter Agreement could only be overturned by another war. Instead, it has been overcome by the nonviolent witness of people who succeeded time after time in finding ways of bearing witness to the truth. So what you have here is partly his skepticism about political realism. He's making, if you will, he was described frequently as a Christian realist. But in this document, he's critical of political realism. And at one point, quite deliberately, quite clearly, he's talking about realism. What he says is that it's the nonviolent activism that made the change possible. And that's really, I think, a very, very important kind of illness. His articulation of that really begins to insert nonviolence as such into Catholic view of things. And then he says at the end of that same passage, may people learn to fight for injustice without violence, again the resistance to evil, renouncing class struggle in the internal disputes and war in international ones. So it's a plea for the use of nonviolence both domestically and internationally. Remember, class struggle was his big difficulty with liberation theology. He rejected liberation theology, particularly because of the doctrines of class struggle that had seemed to take over from Marxism. He goes on later in the document to critique war. And some of it's very rhetorical, but on the other hand, it's really remarkable because generally we take him to be an Augustinian. And one way in which he differs from Augustine and from a lot of political realists who followed Augustine is that he rejects war on consequentialist reasons. He says the outcomes of war make it something that needs to be resisted, and the forces it unleashes that makes peace further more difficult to bring about are reasons that we ought to avoid war. Augustine believed that the evil of war didn't have to do with the harm that was done, but rather with what was wrong in the soul. So if you had bloodlust, that was wrong. If you wanted to dominate other people, that was wrong. But the consequences. He didn't think so. Frequently, his ethic of war is talked about as an ethic of intention. But this is what John Paul says. Never again war, though never again war, which destroys the lives of innocent people, teaches how to kill, throws into upheaval even the lives of those who do the killing, and leaves behind a trail of resentment and hatred, thus making it all the more difficult to find a just solution to the very problems which provoked the war. The other element here, besides, you know, taking the consequences of war seriously, which the Augustinian tradition did not, is that it's a position based on spirituality. If you go back to the first quote, he talks about, the quote at the top, is by uniting his own suffering for the sake of the truth and freedom to the suffering of Christ on the cross that man is able to accomplish the miracle of peace. The Polish tradition had a long messianic tradition of kind of Poland as being a kind of suffering servant in the world, and that it's by uniting oneself with the sufferings of Christ that the end comes. And if you want to read more about that, George Hudson Williams in his Mind of John Paul II has a very good chapter on all that material. But it was a very strong position of Polish piety. And I think what you see generally as things have been developing over the last few years, last few decades, is that even popes more and more provide less doctrinal teaching than they do spirituality, that their own changes to doctrine or such are motivated by spirituality. You see that very much with Pope Francis, I think. But you had it with John Paul II on many fronts. And his attitude towards nonviolence was one of those things. Finally, let me say a bit about the Harvest of Justice and Sona Peace. This was basically the bishop's effort to articulate a post-Cold War strategy. After the fall of the Soviet Union and the breakup of the Soviet Empire, as we're trying to adjust to a new world order, and former Yugoslavia was breaking up, there were a lot of issues we were dealing with, and the document didn't want just to deal with issues of just war, but it wanted to deal with issues of humanitarian intervention, for instance, because there were new issues of warfare that need to be taken up, and some of the refinements of just war doctrine, as you get in the canons of just war, as listed in Harvest of Justice, are refined in light of the previous experience, of previous years. For instance, one of the issues is the question of responsibility of soldiers to accept the risk of harm, which the military was doing less and less, and does even less now, so that civilians are liable to the attack, and we can accept collateral damage with civilian deaths, but we don't want to risk our soldiers if we can possibly do that. And so part of what that list does, the reformulation, you can look at it in the Harvest, is to say, no, soldiers have a responsibility to protect civilians even at risk to themselves. So in any case. But the Harvest of Justice reordered the relationship. It was the first kind of conscious reordering of the relationship between nonviolence and just war. Nonviolence had been kind of the tail. Now, what the bishops were arguing was that nonviolence at the center of a Christian response to conflict, and the just war is a coda for what happens when nonviolence fails. So they summarized their position, and this is really rank. It's like, as our, it's in encyclicals, we used to always have the term, as we have always said. Well, this is the equivalent of we have always said. Our conference approach can be summarized this way. We're directly referring back to the Challenge of Peace, but this is not what the Challenge of Peace had to say. In a situation of conflict, our constant commitment ought to be, as far as possible, to strive for justice through nonviolent means. So the primary aim is to prevent or correct the injustice through nonviolent means. But when sustained attempts at nonviolence fail to protect the innocent against fundamental injustice, the legitimate political authorities are permitted as a last resort to employ limited force to rescue innocent the innocent and establish peace. Archbishop or bishop then on the committee, now a cardinal, when this last summary was approved, raised his arms and said, "This is great! I love it. It's development of doctrine." I was young and was not going to correct him, but I was going to say, "Well, this is returned to an old teaching," but he was very excited about it, and I think it's important for the history of this development. If you want markers for the development, this is a real watershed. The precipitating document was Syntesimus, but this is where it's really put out there, is what its implications are for Catholic teaching. The teaching of this letter or statement has not been well received. Just war people didn't like it because it reduced just war to the tale of the dog of nonviolence, and the pacifists didn't like it because it didn't embrace pacifism. It was still a kind of active nonviolent position, so we weren't rejecting all war in all cases. And so it didn't have really the carriers that the challenge of peace had. And it also was not drafted in the same way. It wasn't drafted the same open way. Cardinal Law had begun with John Paul II's campaign against the bishops' conference having independent power to speak. And so they couldn't consult. We consulted 170 experts, some of them contributed to the volume in which the pastoral statement was published, in essays on various aspects like humanitarian intervention, sanctions, and so on. And that was a way to kind of say, this is not just the bishops; it's the Catholic world, in conjunction with people of goodwill who are in knowledgeable positions, coming up with this teaching. It's not something that's kind of just crafted out of the heads of the bishops. But because of that lack of publicity, unlike the challenge of peace, it's not received the same kind of acceptance. But it nonetheless, I think, is the formal position of the conference. And as you see, bishops moving more and more towards positions of nonviolence when it comes to war, this is why. Now, finally, the Church's position, again, is nonviolent but not pacifist. You can see this in Pope Francis' initial responses to what was going on in Syria. Before he had announced his day of prayer and sent his diplomats out around the world, he made a statement which he said, we have to avoid war as far as possible, but of course in the end we can always use force for the rescue purpose. But that, he only said that once. The rest of the time the insistence was always on other means and try to resist the use of force in Syria. In practice, at least until the Arab Spring, the Church has really identified very closely with the international doctrine of the responsibility to protect, which is very consistent with the political doctrine of Pacem in Terris, the encyclical of John the 23rd. Namely, all political authorities have responsibility for protection of people. If those immediately responsible aren't responsible, outsiders have to intervene. The problem is the approval has to come from the Security Council, and that's what locked us up on Syria. There was an opening in Libya. The Church didn't take a position because the local Christian population was so small they felt they'd be vulnerable if they were asking for outsiders to intervene. So there's politics even in the Church's application of its own moral teaching sometimes. Another critique comes from those like Brian Hare, who says that the position is logically incoherent, that you can't have just war and nonviolence combined. Now, the challenge of peace said that they shared a common presumption against war, so there's that. I've tried to show that what persists in the tradition is the notion that there's a resistance to evil is also part of the tradition that makes them cohere together. But it also strengthens the just war by creating higher thresholds when you can go to war by saying, yeah, you really have to have the means to resist conflict nonviolently, and only when they break down at repeated efforts can you actually go to war. So that's responsibility to protect is helpful there, but the logical inconsistency I don't think holds up, and I think the world itself has moved more and more in the direction of this kind of approach to the use of force. But we do need to distinguish carefully between nonviolence and pacifism. The Church's position is not pacifism, it's active nonviolence. And what's key is that both under the just war and under this teaching on nonviolence, we have an obligation to resist grave public evil. Thank you very much. Okay.